flying graces of Kiranakshami Shri Prabhupada, Kantarachima Bhagatam, or Premanandi Hari Hari Bhagavad, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Sri, Sri Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Shri Prabhupada. So, yesterday you were discussing.
We got to
about the illusory name. Section 2, 5, 12, and 13.
Yeah, now we're on the next one, the Anucheta 24, halfway down the page.
Yeah. So here, Srila Jiva Goswami is on the same subject, but it's completely, you could say, 108 opposite angle of vision on it. So in Bhagavata Sandarbha Anucheta 24, Srila Jiva Goswami makes another point about the verse we've been discussing, we heard him discuss yesterday, and that is Canto 2, Chapter 5, Text 13. And you requested to compare Srila Prabhupada's purport to this same verse here, with Jiva Goswami's commentary. So here, Jiva Goswami says that the goddess Lakshmi is the Lord's limitless internal potency. Her form is a partial expansion of the Lord's form. This is described in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.11.20. Goddess Lakshmi is the constant companion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She is a direct expansion of Lord Hari. To Sridhara Swami comments, the constant companion here is the Lord's own potency. The reason for this is given in the words Shakshad Atmana, directly manifested from the Lord. Because the Lord's form is perfectly spiritual, and because she is not different from his form, she is his internal potency. The word Shakshat directly here confirms that Goddess Lakshmi is not the same as the illusory potency Maya. This is confirmed by the following description of the illusory potency, Srimad Bhagavatam 2.5.13. The illusory energy of the Lord is ashamed to be seen by the Lord. So, I was also reading last night, working on another section of the Bhagavatam. Shukadeva Goswami giving yet another explanation about the shyness of Maya Devi. Maharaj read and discussed that yesterday very nicely. But there's also the point that Maya Devi has, because actually one of the names of Durga is Vaishnavi, so she's devotee. So she has a great problem, in a sense, with those jivas that turn their back on the Lord. In one purport, Srila Prabhupada explains the words Rudra and Rudrani, which are just other names for Lord Shiva and Goddess Durga. And so the word Rudra, Rud, means to bellow, or I think you could probably finagle a connection with the English word roar, possibly. Anyway, it means to make a, you know, like a bellowing sound, like a beast being hit. And Prabhupada explained the purport that this is the business of Rudra and Rudrani in this material world. It's just to put the living entities in different painful situations so that they cry out. And so it's interesting because Jiva Goswami, he picks up this point and he develops it into a further explanation of her shyness before the Lord. She's out there giving his parts and parcels a good whipping. And, you know, she feels bad about doing it herself, because she's actually a Vaishnavi. And she feels bad coming before the Lord from the woodshed, you know, with a freshly marked up stick. So she'd rather not bother the Lord in his transcendental pastimes with the duty that she has accepted. So anyway, I found that kind of interesting and funny. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's for her.
So, now I can continue. In Bhagavat Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami comments upon Bhagavatam 2.5.39, Srila Prabhupada's purport, the same verse should be consulted. So, in Anucheta 67, speaking to Narada, Lord Brahma describes the etymology of Vaikuntha Loka in the following words of Srimad Bhagavatam 2.5.39, that from the forefront of the chest up to the neck of the universal form of the Lord are situated the planetary systems named Janaloka and Tapaloka, whereas Satyaloka, the topmost planetary system, is situated on the head of the form. The spiritual planets, however, are eternal. So I mentioned yesterday that the Satyaloka would include Dhruvaloka, which is the Sveta Dvipa, the place of Lord Vishnu, and also Kailash, and also Brahmaloka, as the planet of Chaturmukha Brahma. That is the head of the Lord, and it's considered, Janaloka and Tapaloka are considered like suburbs of these places, because they're also, this is going to actually be explained, I believe, in the next chapter in greater detail, but only living entities who are in there, what's known as Karnadeha, can dwell in these regions. Karnadeha means, it's also, we mentioned this, Pragya. Prabhupada translates this in connection, I think it's in the seventh canto, as meaning the causal element, or the causal factor, pragya. So pragya is associated with Lord Mahavishnu. So it's not very difficult at the end of creation for Brahma to go see Mahavishnu, because Brahma is in what's known as a Karnadeha. You know, the long name for Mahavishnu is Karnadakashayi Vishnu. Karna means causal. So, yeah, Prabhupada uses the term causal designation for pragya. And taijasa, is Prabhupada says, is the subtle designation. So these Janalok, Tapalok, and Satyalok are in the most subtle region of the universe. It is even beyond the linga sharira, the power of our mind, you know. But our mind works when we speak of thinking, feeling, and willing. This is sattva-guna, thinking, yes. Raja-guna is feeling, and tamo-guna, the exercise of will, one's energy to claim a thing, to do a thing, and say, I have done this. That is false ego, or tamo-guna. So that's a linga sharira. It's consciousness being affected on the subtle platform by the three modes of nature. But these regions just mentioned are beyond the active modes. They're simply in the mode of material goodness. That means Of course, potential of the other two modes are there. Certainly there are great progenitors and so on living up there. They go there after they finish their progenitive business. But on another day of Brahma, they may come down to do that again. So in these planets, the Stula Sharira, what would be called the body of gross elements, it's there because Lord Brahma and his associates, they have mastery over everything, over all the elements in the universe, so it's not a problem for them to also take on a gross body and a subtle body for certain duties. But they themselves, their consciousness is fixed in trance, and that's on the Karna platform. So they're not diverted by the pullings of the senses towards their objects or the happiness and distress of the mind. You see, for example, the four Kumaras, they're clearly in this status because they're considered the Jnana Shakti of the Lord. Is the actual potency of impersonal realization are embodied by the four Kumaras, and they live up there. They move around up there. They're sometimes they're going to Kailash. They always like to get together, the four of them, and come up with the real skull-breaking questions, and then they go to either Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva and lay them out. We've been talking in the 11th canto that describes the appearance of Hamsa avatar. You see, Brahma becomes bewildered by their question. Even he can't answer. And it's explained because their question is about separating the, you know, that the mind and senses are just seamlessly joined together. What would be a mind without sense objects? You see, and then the reverse is that old question. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? You see, what would be a sense object without a mind? And because Brahma, he looks upon this creation as something he has done, so he too got into the same problem. Yeah, how do I, in order to understand what the question they're asking, I would have to pull myself completely away. But I can't do that because I'm Brahma, I'm the Lord's Rajaguna avatar. So he sort of momentarily stumbled in his bhakti vigyan and slipped back also in, you know, by their association. He kind of, you know, that sometimes happens, you know. You can meet very, you know, there's some very intellectual types of even devotees, or we might get into a discussion with a favorable professor of philosophy or something, and he starts taking us down the yellow brick road of, you know, well, if you say this, then logically it means this, and that means this, and that means this, and finally, you know, you're looking how we get over here, you know. It's hard to retrace the steps back to the Vaishnava philosophy sometimes. So that's momentarily happened to Brahma just to facilitate the appearance of Hamsa avatar. And the Jiva Goswami, he explains that when Hamsa avatar appeared, you see, the four Kumaras being, because at that time their realization was impersonal, they were asking that question. Because mind and the senses and their objects are the reflection of personality. So Prabhupada points this out also in the purport on a very similar question asked by Devahuti to Kapiladeva. And he says, Prabhupada's comment this, it's very similar to the question, the main question of the four Kumaras. And Srila Prabhupada's comment to Devahuti's question is, this is more or less voidism, you see, because the one on this impersonal jnana platform doesn't know what to do with the mind and senses, and would just like to throw them off. So that was really the point of the question, and this throwing it off means then you become one. So when Hamsa Avatar appeared, four Kumaras, because they're so fond of asking questions, and they saw this beautiful incarnation of the Lord as a swan, he's very nicely described. So they asked, who are you? And Hamsa Avatar's reply is, that's a stupid question. And Jiva Goswami explains, because he started on their platform. So you're the guys who say everything is one. I appear, and then you say, who are you? So what kind of dumb question is, you know, that to ask? And then the four Kumaras are stunned.
Never been called dumb.
He turns the tables, you know, like Brahma. They stunned Brahma, so he stunned them, you know, because he doesn't like his main representative, you know, his acharya of the Brahma Sampradaya, to be made look foolish. So he just did the same, you know, he just gave them a zap of their own medicine and told them in the original Sanskrit, I forgot the original Sanskrit right now, but it translates to what you have just asked is a meaningless string of words. You know, it's perfect impersonal philosophy. But then he goes on to lead them to the Vaishnav conclusion. Because this is a story, it's actually being retold by Lord Krishna himself in answering a question of Uddhav. So he refers to this very, very ancient discussion. He says this happens millions of years before the appearance of the Hamsa Avatar. So again, this is the system. When the other day we were seeing how Srila Goswami refers to a discussion between what were we saying? Yes, Narada and Lord Brahma. No, sorry, it was Sukadeva Goswami referring to the question of Narada and Lord Brahma. Narada to Lord Brahma. Prabhupada says he uses this phrase, within the Vedic circles of discussion. This is the process. It is actually more impressive that you quote an authority very exactingly, and like that quality of Shuka bring out even more clearly for this, you know, the story is being told again, but now applied in a different Deshakalapatra. So, of course, because time has passed, now different angles of vision have to be examined. Millions of years ago, many things could just be taken for granted because everyone was so intelligent, but now people are less intelligent, so you see Lord Krishna discuss, he gives a big his own purport to Hamsa Avatar's explanation, and then of course the acharyas giving their purports to Lord Krishna's purport, and this is why the Bhagavatam is so nectarian. This is as Prabhupada would say, in Vedic circles, much better than trying to come up with your own, you know, unique new example and explanation. Although that can be done, of course, Srila Prabhupada did it. There's also a lesson in that, showing how everything, even now, as crazy it is still connected to Krishna. So Prabhupada would give examples of light bulbs and computers and airplanes and tugboats and things like that, just to show us the connection. But when we talk of the Bhagavata Ras, then yes, from our modern viewpoint, to be able to enter into these ancient discussions, in other words, they're not ancient, they're eternal. You know, the pyramids of Giza are, you know, the pyramids of Geezer are ancient.
The geezers buried at Giza.
The wrapped up geezers inside, they're ancient. They have nothing to tell you.
Mum's the word.
Yeah. Right. Very good. Mum's the word. And the hieroglyphics also don't mean anything. And, you know,
all looks like hieroglyphics.
The dog-headed god and all of that. You know, all of it is, has become absolutely meaningless. I mean, you know, there are... Let's see, because I read a lot, you know, like Egyptology, the whole science of Egyptology is one of the most ridiculed sciences there are. Because everyone knows, I mean, it's just so clear that the Egyptologists, they don't know what they're talking about, but it's just egoism. It's just someone somehow rises to the top and says, this was like this, and this was like that. But the whole thing started, the whole subject of Egyptology started in Europe when a Christian monk cut off something like 20,000 years of lists of kings' names, because the Egyptian civilization actually goes back to the demigods. But because everything had to fit within their 4004 BC creation, he just chopped off all these previous kings, which finally the last names were, they came down from heaven and settled this place. And then it, what we're seeing of the Egyptian civilization is just the remnant of something that was much greater. It's always been noted that the ancient name, that, you know, in India, the ancient name for Egypt is Mishra, and Mishra happens to be a common Brahmin name. And it's also known, and even archaeologists admit, that Indians were living there. But it's just that the
some say
local people, you know, they just fell away more and more. That's as Kali Yuga advances, then the Vedic civilization has to retreat. Anyway, so no one, you know, Egyptology is just, no one knows what it means, you know. Like, it is so full of insane mysteries. Like, recently they found, you know, a new batch of mummies, or they were re-examining an old batch or something. Anyway, they were looking at the mummies, and they found inside, you know, wrapped inside the mummy. You know, because the idea was they apparently think, I don't even know if this is true, but their idea is that they prepared these bodies so in this way so that the souls could rise up into higher planets. That's the traditional explanation. And the pyramid was some kind of, you know, astro-mythical yantra to help project the soul up. That's what they say. And then they would... because these mummies were kings or very noble people, they would assemble accoutrements, necessary items around. So they recently started finding that the mummies even have little stashes of cocaine in them. And that the white powder cocaine. And the problem with that is that cocaine was not discovered until South America was discovered. So... You know, now they're scratching their head. How did these Egyptians 5,000 years ago get cocaine? Because it's only you in South America. And don't dare say that there was any connection between those two continents. That's impossible. Even though there are pyramids in South America too. But don't dare say there was any connection. That's That's Egyptology, that's paleontology, archaeology. It's just puffed up, whiskey drinking idiots, you know.
Meaningless string of words.
Yeah, just pontificating. And then now there's a new generation coming up with, you know, wild Jimi Hendrix hair, you know, funny round glasses, and they're going back to the 20,000-year-old model, and they're saying, yeah, why couldn't ships have sailed back and forth between? So we hope that they are also starting to look more generously upon the Vedic civilization. There are satellite photographs of the Saraswati River now, you know, that shows it was a huge river in western India that got up to 7 miles wide. I mean, that means you couldn't see the other side of it, you know, like a lake. So they've had to admit that there was an Indus Saraswati civilization. They used to doubt that, you know, that the Saraswati was just somebody's imagination. This is what they do. One guy says, I think they meant the Sarayu River, you know, which is in Ayodhya. And someone else would say, I think they meant, you know, the Chalukya River. Or whatever. Just taking stabs. So we need not listen to these fools on any subject matter. We need to listen to Maharaj now. Because I've put in my half hour. Telling you a little bit about sages and a lot about idiots. Now we're going to hear from Maharaj a lot about sages and only a little about idiots.
Maybe it was the Saratoga.
Swanee.
So that's actually an Egyptian song that's just been adapted. Okay. Unless you're from there, you won't catch that.
My dear old mummy.
Oh, actually, it was my dear old mummy before. So there's a connection between. You did the thing on the Brahma Loka, no?
Yes. Okay. This verse, the word Brahma Loka, yeah, Shri Swami's comment refers to the eternal. Oh, yeah. Let me just read that. Sanatana and Vaikuntha planets. Here, the word Brahma Loka does not refer to any planet within the created material universe. Here, the word Brahma Loka means spiritual Brahma planet Loka. Okay, so. Now, Jiva Goswami will continue, and Maharaj can, on the same subject, so Maharaj can take that up.
In Krishna Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami again writes about Brahma Loka as meaning spiritual planet. He comments on Bhagavatam 2.5.42 and 39, compared to 39 purport and 42, second purport. The word Swarga is defined in the following verse, Srimad Bhagavatam 2.5.42. Others may divide the whole planetary system into three divisions, namely the lower planetary systems on the legs up to the earth, the middle planetary systems on the navel, and the upper planetary systems, Swargaloka, from the chest to the head of the Supreme Lord. The Brahmaloka planet described in these verses as above, Swargaloka, is the spiritual world of Vaikuntha, the abode of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and not the abode of the demigod Brahma. The word Brahma, which means great, here refers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because He is supremely great. His greatness is shown by the fact that His transcendental form is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss, Nimesha. The planets arranged upon the body of the Lord are divided thus, according to the Bhagavatam's description of the qualities of the inhabitants. Adholokas, Bilaswarga, where the Asuras live. Atala, Vital, Sutal, Mahatal, Rasatal, and Talatal. Then Madhyalokas, Martyaloka, and Devaswargalokas. Burloka, Svaloka, Svargaloka, and Maharloka. And Urdvalokas, Munilokas. Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Satyaloka. I think we're missing one of the Adho lokas. Huh? Oh, patal. Yeah, no, yeah. Patal, just below atal. Patal, atal, vital. Like that. Nimisha, a different way of dividing the triloka, three worlds, which is often seen in scripture, is exemplified by the text 20 of the third ray of light, Hari Bhakti Ratna Prakash, by Srila Raghava Das Goswami. The planets where we reside are known as Burloka. The planets above us, reaching up to the sun planet, are known as Bhuvarloka. The planets above Bhuvarloka, reaching up to Dhruvaloka, are called Svargaloka. That the word Brahmaloka means the spiritual world of Vaikuntha is confirmed by the words of Srimad Bhagavatam. Here the word Brahmaloka is clearly used to mean the spiritual world. Thus Krishna led all the cowherd men headed by Nanda Maharaj to the lake where Akura was later shown Brahmaloka, the Vaikuntha planetary system. They took their bath immediately and saw the real nature of Brahmaloka, the Vaikuntha lokas. The following verse from Srimad Bhagavatam 2539 also uses the word Brahmaloka to mean the spiritual world of Vaikuntha. Satyaloka, the topmost planetary system, is situated on the head of the universal form. The spiritual planets, Brahmaloka, however, are eternal. This interpretation of the word Brahmaloka is confirmed by Sridhar Swami, who comments on this verse. In this verse, Brahmaloka refers to the Vaikuntha planetary systems, which is Sanatana, or eternal. The Vaikuntha world is not within the material creation. Okay, so now, Jiva Goswami is making this difference in that we do not make the mistake that Brahmaloka, that Brahma's loka is spiritual. Right? It's still within the material creation. So up to Brahma, then we're still within material nature. Right? And then, so that's important, because then we're very clear that Vaikuntha means beyond. Otherwise, we think just a better material arrangement then is good enough. Does this make sense? We can improve what's here, but actually what we're trying to do is go beyond what's here. Right? So what's here is temporary, as is Lord Brahma and his planets. But the Vaikuntha planets are not. They're eternal. So all this is to make that difference between the two so that we do not make any, how you say, connection in this way. There's Brahmaloka, which is the topmost, but yogis go there. That's the natural place where they go. It's not said that the devotees go there. Right? Devotees go to Vaikuntha. Yogis go to Brahmaloka. Pious people then go to the Svargaloka. Like that. And the, the impersonalists, they go to Brahman. They don't actually make it to the loka. Though, in their description, they'll call that Brahmaloka. Right? Mm. So when it's talking like, Te Brahmaloke, then Vaishnavas know that means the Vaikuntha planets. The impersonalists will think that that means the Brahman. And the karmis, they will think Brahmaloka means where Brahma resides. So that means by this activity, karmic activity, I will get the most benefit by going to the planet of Brahma, even beyond Indra. Right? The same verse will be read by the impersonalists, and they'll think by this activity, I will go to the Brahman. And the devotees know that means I will go to Krishna's place. Mm. Right? The scriptures are written very cleverly like that. Like you see in you see it in Lot, basically all the concluding statements of the Manusamhita, then they will mention verses like this. So that whether the jnani, the karmi, or the devotee reads it, they will be inspired to follow the Dharmashastra. Mm-hmm. Because all three of them will get their result. Right? The karmi, by following it, then gets the karmic result of going to Lord Brahma's planet. The jnani, by following it in Naishkarmya, then will go to the Brahman. And the devotee, by following it to please Krishna, goes back to Godhead. Right? So Jiva Goswami here is making it very clear that actually Brahmaloka doesn't mean any of these other two. Right? Here he's specifically saying Brahma's planet. I'm sure at someplace else he'll make it very clear that it doesn't mean the Brahma Jyoti either. right? Because the Vedas will use all three definitions for Brahmaloka. So it's, you know, to us it doesn't make much sense, just like you know, the blasphemy, what is it? To consider the names of the Lord as, you know, equal to the demigods, you know, I mean, we never even heard of the demigods, right? Mm-hmm. Or to consider the chanting of Hare Krishna as equal to one of the ritualistic activities in Karmakanda is kind of like karma what? Mm-hmm. You know, like that, you know. So they don't make as much sense to us, but the acharyas are writing for the broad audience, you know, like that. And so there are many who grow up in this culture. And to them, Brahmaloka will mean Brahman or Brahma's planet, not Vaikuntha.
This is the same point that was made yesterday about the, you know, Adhyatmik, Adhidaivik, and Adhibhautik, these three levels of understanding. Bhagavad understanding, the Adhyatmik means the two orders of Atma, always.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's understood. Mm-hmm. The higher jnanis, you know, the ones who actually are able to cross over the karna jal, which that really weeds a lot of them out.
Yeah, quite a few.
most of them don't manage to get across. But the few that do, then they just... Their actual place is Sadashiva Loka, which is also known as Siddha Loka. Siddha in the sense of, that's a way of describing impersonal liberation. And in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Gop Kumar goes there. And he's, there is a form of the Lord, a presiding deity of Siddha Loka, who is an, you know, expansion of Krishna. And Gop Kumar has such devotion for Krishna that he was seeing, here's my Lord. But that form of the Lord is there to absorb the impersonalists. You know, there are impersonalists who want to go into the Jyoti, the Brahmanandis, so they'll go into the effulgence around the Lord, and then there's another Ishwara Sayuja, who actually want, they think they will become the Lord, you know, by being drawn into his body. So he's facilitating them. And so Gop Kumar in bhakti was approaching this form of the Lord and then found himself being pulled into, you know, wait, what's going on? He found himself merging into the Lord, and he didn't like this. And it was like Mother Yashoda also, you know, when she looked in Krishna's mouth, in the end she was, how could I have ever thought he was Krishna? You know, my son, little Krishna, this is the Supreme Lord. And her whole mood was changing. So Krishna didn't like that, so he withdrew that covering potency. So similarly, at this point, then Lord Shiva comes, because he's kind of it's kind of like Dhruvaloka also, Sadashivaloka. There's the Lord presiding, but at Dhruvaloka, Dhruva is managing everything. He's... the Lord is the deity,
CEO.
Simply the deity, and Dhruva is the temple manager. And so it's the same as Sadashiva Loka. There is a deity of the Lord there, and everything is being run, the worship and everything, and the merging, and who goes where, you know, that's all being managed by Lord Shiva. So he comes with a big smile on his face, riding on Nandi, and says, Gop Kumar, this is not the place for you. Go farther. This is here. We hang up. This is the last hang up for those who still treasure, you know, some touch of impersonalism in their heart. They even get the chance for darshan, but they, at the last moment, choose merging over serving. So this is not your place. So you just, so by Lord Shiva's permission, he was able to continue on. So anyway, my point was is that this is the real understanding of Adhyatmik. Mm. You know, that there's Atma Paramatma. There's relationship. And a muddled, the Brahmananda impersonalists who have a muddled Adhyatmik understanding. And then there's, like what Maharaj was describing, most impersonalists, they don't even come to the adhyatmic understanding at all. They're in the adhyatmic. This is like Ramakrishna mission. They think we'll get there by worshipping goddess Kali, right? Mm-hmm. Worshipping. Now they don't even do that, you know. I heard I think at the original temple of Shirdi Sai Baba in Maharashtra, the first one, the main one, because he is supposed to reincarnate. So the astrologers did a whole chart, a very elaborate chart, and they figured out that Shirdi Sai, I think everyone from India knows who Shirdi Sai Baba is, not the South Indian Sai Baba. He's such a sadhu. This other one, Shirdi Sai, with
The one that didn't stick his finger in the electric socket.
Anyway, Shirdi Sai, these Brahmin astrologers discovered that he had reincarnated as a street dog. So that dog was found and placed on the Vyasasan. This happened within the last couple of years. And I'm not joking. I'm not making it up. This is a true story. All the Sai Baba followers, you know, the rickshaw wallahs and taxi drivers, they put this dog on the big asan, meant for the original Shirdi Sai Baba, put, you know, the big Purush type of turban on his head, you know, and dressed him in silks and garlanded the dog and fed him sweetmeats, and Brahmins were chanting Vedic mantras, fire sacrifices. So this, you know, the impersonalists, this is, you know, Adi Bautik. You know? Dog is just a Buddha, just an ordinary living entity. So their impersonalists don't even
get that,
you know, get to be, you know, beyond first base, you know, in Kali Yuga. And then the better ones, you know, it's just some demigod. In the name of liberty, you know, this name, worship it, you know, all roads lead to Rome. Any demigod you worship will lead to liberation. Panchapasana. That's mainly. So that's actually adhyatmic. Mm. Not adhyatmic.
Yeah, though they talk adhyatmic, but
yeah,
they talk. But it's not actually.
They don't know what it means. Yeah. That's why we're so, you know, we cannot believe how fortunate we are.
Yeah.
The Prabhupada has made these points so clear because they are so unclear
to everyone else. Yeah, there was one example where some big Sanskrit scholar and like this had come in and was talking to Prabhupada. Prabhupada asked him, you know, define God and, you know, something simple that we would call simple questions. He was saying, oh no, this is very difficult and this and that and different shastras. He's just going on and on and on. And probably called over one of the Gurukul boys, you know, 8-year-old kid, says, you know, describe what does God mean? And he said, Krishna, Supreme Person, like this and that. He says, this kid can say it, why can you? You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're the big pundit, but this kid knows more than you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was reading this interesting thing last night. Jiva Goswami was saying, there are scholars who, scholar devotees, you know, Mishra Bhaktas. And so that's all right. But Jiva Goswami, he says, you know, their danger is becoming proud of their knowledge and then thinking them superior, you know, thinking because I know so many things, I'm superior to the simple devotees. Jiva Goswami goes on to say that a simple devotee who doesn't, you know, just doesn't have the capacity to really understand the philosophy very clearly, all these fine points, like we do in our course here, talking about sambandha, abhideya, prayojana. Now, someone may not be able to follow all these things. Jiva Goswami says, he writes, that's fine as long as this person knows not to commit offenses. If they just know that, then they go back home, back to Godhead. Whereas the one who knows all these things but becomes proud, and then becomes, it's a, actually a form of envy manifesting against the simple devotees. Jiva Goswami says he, the Lord manifests before him 100 archers with drawn bows. Such a graphic, beautiful, symbol, He's on his spiritual path, and then there's 100, from the Lord Narayan's army with drawn arrows pointed right at him. So, this pride is a very serious fault.
Yeah, it's interesting, because just on that fault is that you think means, how you get it back, like the last snare of Maya for the impersonalist is that I'm God.
Yeah.
But then there's subtler forms of that, that I am the devotee.
Right.
It's also the other. Yeah, so it's like, so I'm great, I'm the devotee. Because that means you either think, because ultimately we're just servant of the devotee. There's Krishna, and then there's his eternal servants, and then we're their servants. And so if we ever think we are them, then that's also wrong. So this, then it mentions that if one thinks I'm a great devotee or I'm advanced, then these two will put a blockage in one's service. Not necessarily now, it's mentioned specifically for the third stage of Bhava Bhakti. You get stuck there, you can't get beyond it, like that. So it's, so then I am what do you call it? I'm advanced, would be like that position of your existence. So it would be a subtle aspect of I am Krishna, And the other one is I'm a great devotee, is that, of the devotees. So it's a very, I am guru of devotees. That's the other one. I am guru of devotees. But Radharani, she's a guru of devotees. Her associates, they're guru of devotees. So being guru of devotees then means this, we'll go back to not fully understanding his internal potency. And thinking I'm advanced means you don't actually understand Krishna's position and our position in relationship. So very, very subtle.
These very subtle things are. That's why there's Chaitanya Charitamrita, because they're brought out very clearly. As you were describing this, I was thinking of that Balabhacharya, because Lord Chaitanya told him, he said there actually, when one comes fully into the realm of personalism, then there are still two stages. One is called Aishwarya Gyan, and the other is called Kevala Bhakti. Mm-hmm. So Lord Chaitanya directly told Balabhacharya, you're only on the Aishwarya Gyan stage. Which means that he's a devotee in the sense of being a personalist, fully accepting the personal form of the Lord. But there is more interest in the Lord's display of Aishwarya than in the Lord himself. You see. And therefore you have this sampradayas that even go so far as to say Radha and Krishna are expanded from Lakshmi and Ryan, etc., etc. Because they're more interested in Aishwarya. And then that means, you see, what's subtly behind that is there's a big position waiting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Loka Vrindavan, Krishna, he just mingles with the crowd. He's sometimes defeating cowherd boys, sometimes they're defeating him.
There's also another, just thought of it as very subtle, is that there's always these things about how we're Vaidhi and everybody else is Raganuga.
Mm.
Is that, and here when you just said about the Aishwarya, there would be another like subtler form, because there's like a subtler form of this Aishwarya, in that the focus is on the energy rather than the energetic. So one could say that, you know, as devotees of Radharani, so then all of our interest is Radharani and like that. But actually it's not Radharani. I mean, it is, but more important than, means the most important element of Radharani is her perspective. So in other words, all we do is talk about Krishna, but from her perspective. That's the actual, you know, topmost worship of the Shakti or the Aishwarya, rather than just seeing the person Aishwarya is. That person is manifest because of their mood. The more important than the form of the and the, you know, the externals of that person is the mood on which they do it. So in that way, one would can understand is then those groups that put the really emphasis on Radharani, they're actually the ones that are more Vaikuntha. They're the Aishwarya. Yeah. Because they're not seeing from the perspective of her as they are as much about her. And yeah. And then you can even inverse that if you really want to have fun, is that when one thinks of, you know, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, means Radha and Krishna are together, from whose viewpoint do you see it? Right? The general tendency is from Krishna. You know, you see, you know, Krishna touches Radharani, so you see it, the male touching the female, rather than the female being touched by the male, because of our Purusha Bhav. So we'll still, so there's all these very subtleties, so even though it's claiming to be Raganuga, it's actually Vaikuntha mixed with Purusha Bhav. Well, what Prabhupada was giving is from the angle of Radharani, so therefore all you see is Krishna. You know, so much more, much, much more subtle. It's not an obviously Raganuga platform.
Raghunath Das Goswami is celebrated as showing the real proper mood of Manjari Bhav in relationship to Radharani. Because he's Rati Manjari.
Rati.
Yeah. So Rati Manjari becomes very shy when Radharani is, you know, we shall be so pleased with her service that she'll want to just show some intimate friendship, you know, touch her or embrace her. And Rati Manjari immediately, with folded hands and bowed head, says, "Please do not become friendly like this with me, because I am simply your servant." So the Manjari Bhava is, that's what it is. It is actually the Dasya Rasa in Madhura Rasa.
Yeah. Is your Dasya towards Radharani, but your relationship with Krishna is, is conjugal, but it's only through her vision. Yeah. It means seeing through Radharani, then you see Krishna. You don't see Krishna separately. Yeah.
Prabhupada put it so simply when he said in one lecture that our perfection is to see how God is enjoying. You see? So that doesn't mean sitting like a spectator. That means one is actively actively seeing, means seeing that everything is in the place for Krishna's enjoyment with Srimati Radharani. This is what we aspire to see.
It's like I'd say the like if you're serving prasad, you're watching to see the pleasure of those that you're serving, you know, checking is there. So it's not a, like you're saying, it's not a, you're just standing by and watching and they're happy, you know, you're active, but you know, in this case, and you're active on, there's somebody in charge of the prasad serving, and so you're seeing to their pleasure, but because it's, you know,
it's
this person
doing it. Here, what Mara's the example he just gives, it's just a very neat code, code key for the whole Rasa Tattva. Because the Goswamis are, they're the Rasa Tattva Acharyas, particularly Rupa Goswami. But how they reach that platform by service, by being such exacting servants of the Lord in that mood. So they know just when, now we have to bring this, we have to arrange that. They measure when and how things must be done according to the ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
That the ecstasy for them is simply like a barometer.
They're not looking at it for themselves.
Yeah, it's a barometer of their service. So
you have the one where this is also, I think, Angelika and Rati. Rati is there fanning Radha Krishna and the coins. So, they have that kind of, it's like a big rug, and then you have the rope that pulls it, So he's pulling on the rope. And you can see the pastime. So it's a very nice situation. So you think this is the perfect, ideal Krishna conscious situation. And then Rupa comes along and just says, leave that rope. It's not like, all this, like honey-covered words and all that. It's just, forget the rope. We got other more important things to do. And then they go off to arrange the next pastime, because you only have like 20 minutes, So they're arranging the next pastime so that all the garlands, all the clothes, everything is all there, that whatever Radharani's wearing in the kunj, it'll be, disheveled by being with Krishna.
Yes.
Then they come and redress her and everything, so she looks exactly before she went to the kunj, so that when Radha and Krishna sit outside, Lalita, who is off arranging for the dance, the rasa dance, to see that, the beach is swept and all the instruments, everything is there. When she comes back, now they're ready for the rasa dance, and then expects to see Radha and Krishna have been in the kunj, and it looks as though they weren't. And so the look on Lalita's face, and that joy that brings Radharani that she's tricked her, then, that's what you're working for. So you left the rope for that. So it's like, they just go on. It's like you said, it's a barometer of what's happiness. It's not like how much happiness I'm getting out of it. No, it's how much happiness are they getting out of it.
And so when we hear these things, our proper response should just be one of, first of all, humility. Mm-hmm. Because we are actually, I'm especially, considering myself being born in the West, when I hear Mars talk like this, the first thing I think about is how far away I am. this the whole culture,
mm-hmm.
Because even though in the West, I studied history a lot. So you go back in Western history and there's something that starts to resemble, the external aspects of Vedic culture, but there's nothing like this.
Mm.
What you say in Greek mythology, or it's not actually proper to use the word mythology, but anyway, you have the story of the Gorgon Medusa. She was the most beautiful woman in the world on the planet Earth. And then she was so beautiful decorating herself that some demigoddess became envious of her. She got into a conflict. The demigoddess said, you shouldn't try to, you're an earth woman, you shouldn't try to be more beautiful than we are. And then she gave a typical spiteful female answer, I am more beautiful than you. And then she got turned into that famous Gorgon half snake with snake hairs, and whoever she looked at would be turned to stone. So that's all you get from Western cultures, is the bad things that were done and the reactions
got for it.
But no idea what is supposed to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they tell you what you don't do. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions that the that third manomoy, that we would take the religious platform, that technically world religions aren't on that platform, because manamoy means that you're actually functioning on what is actually the nature of something. Maybe you haven't fully understood the nature of the soul and God, but at least that, but they're working on is that, so there's relationship. But the world religions work on fear. You're only afraid of God. If I do this, then is eternal damnation, a thunderbolt will come and a zot and this little pile of, you know, stuff.
And he actually says, you know, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, that in bhakti there is no place for that type of, of course we should fear offenses and that sort of thing, but that type of self-demeaning, you know, fear, where, you know, I've had Christian preachers argue on the street that, you know, even if you're a perfect Christian, you can never stand in the presence of God, because He's God. So, you know, their understanding of heaven is that the Christians get together, have some kind of picnic, but God's always somewhere else.
It's like the story of
the Garden of Eden. When He comes, and everyone is like, they're shaking in their boots. You know? There's no question of, you know, Kijai, let's render some service. They're just, when is He going to leave? Is He going yet? They might curse me, or, you know.
Yeah, and afterwards, okay. Oh, not ashes yet. Okay.
So there's nothing positive in these. It's all, you know, based on a negative principle. Nivritti only, I think.
How do they work out this heaven aspect of he's just at the door, and they themselves hang out in different groups, you know, between the Catholics and the Jews and the Protestants and all their little cliques or something?
Yeah, they actually, I mean, many years ago I had a talk about this with Rabindra Swarup, who you may know, he's one of the leading intellectuals, and we were talking about this, and then I proposed to him, I said, what do you think about, you know, because they are doing something, you know, pious, so what do you think about them all becoming Yamadutas in the next life? And he said, that's very interesting. Because they just understand God as a judge, and, you know, people get punished or rewarded.
Well, yeah, that's right. He sends them, they go to hell with that.
Yeah, that's how they preach, you know, with angry faces, and that's how the Yamadutas are described. You know?
There is a technical thing where it mentions about Yamadutas, but, I mean, that idea that they're actually worshipping Yama rather than, you know, God there, because there is the heavenly aspect of Yamaraj.
Right.
He has this, you know, the associates. Huh? But it mentions that when someone, Pitri, the forefather, when somebody doesn't do the Shraddha rites, then they start to get really hungry and a bit, you know, stressed. And then when that goes on long enough that no one's ever done any offerings, then they start to take on those freaky, like, looks that a Yamaduta does. Then they're awarded the position of a Yamaduta.
To punish those who don't do,
you know, in other words, they're there because they're pious, and they're suffering because of impiety. So then they're so enthused, they go on a crusade against anybody who is impious, so they very happily go and collect the sinful people. And they get a cut of the general Shraddha rites, they get a percentage. That's how they maintain themselves. Okay. I guess we should end here. On that happy note. So. Oh,
see,
one thing, tomorrow's Ram Nomi. Is there some special temple program? Or anyone's heard, not heard? But that's later. I'm talking at this time in the class. They generally do discussions, not at this. Okay, class and class. But on Thursday, I think, is Jagvedakta Maharaj's Vyas Puja. Does anything special go on at this time? Generally, he gives class, no? He gives class in the temple. So it's probably better. On Thursday, we won't have class. Okay, so we'll run tomorrow and then again on Friday.
Okay.
Will we study Mahabharata? No, that we would also not do. Yeah. Okay.
So you're still having it? Mahabharata 6?
Yeah, 6 to 7. In the same days as the Bhagavad. Guntaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samadita Bhaktivarinda ki, Jayanatai Gaura Premanandi.